I'm Brian Curtis.
I'm Wendy Ring, and this is Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. We tend to think of Americans as being highly mobile. Well, not recently, but in general. But actually, 72% of us remain in or near the town we grew up in. These long-term relationships with place are causing a new kind of grief as climate change alters the seasons, traditions, and landscapes we thought we could count on. But these same connections are also leading some to stand up against tremendous odds to protect the land and communities they hold dear. Diane Wilson of Seadrift, Texas, and Sharon Levine of Welcome, Louisiana are two such women. These are their stories. Meet Diane.
I'm a fourth-generation fisherwoman on the Texas Gulf Coast. I've been on a shrimp boat probably since I was 8 years old. When you have a fishing family, the place that is home is the bay. You notice the currents, the color, what the fish are doing, how the dolphins are acting.
In the 1960s, fishermen began to notice something else.
Chemical plants all along the bay, Alcoa, Formosa, Union Carbide, Dow, DuPont, Interplast. When you would go past them at night, they looked like a fairyland.
By the late 1980s, it was plain to fishermen that something was wrong.
Local shrimping was beginning a decline from which it has yet to recover.
When my dad was shrimping, Seadrift probably had 120 boats. You could go out in August, shrimp till November, December, and you could make enough of a living that you could last the winter. Now the season is over with in several days. We might have 3 boats that go out fishing now. I was running a fish house because I wasn't making any money shrimping. One of the shrimpers that I took care of, I unloaded his shrimp. I gave him ice or fuel, wrote out his ticket at the end of the week. He had 3 different types of cancer. And one day he came in, he pitched a newspaper at me. And on the front of the paper were the headlines, our tiny little county. I mean, we were 18,000 in the entire county. We were number one in the nation for toxic waste. We had half the waste in the state of Texas.
And a lot of that waste was finding its way into the bay, which was the source of her livelihood.
I am basically an introvert. I am one of these people that doesn't like to speak. I don't like to be around crowds. I can remember when I was a child hiding under a bed to get away from people. It was probably a reason why I was so good on the bay, because there's a lot of solitude out there. But when I saw that article, I did something totally out of character. I walked down to City Hall and I said, I want to have a meeting about this information. By the next day, I had the city secretary down at the fish house. Nobody comes down the fish house. Trust me, it's just fishermen with boots and smelling like shrimp. And here was the city secretary in this nice flowery dress. And she was like, Diane, you're going to have to not do this. And I'm like, well, okay, well, I'll take it to the cafeteria, the elementary school. And they're like, no, Diane, you have to take it entirely out. The bank president, who I had never talked to in my life, come out on the dock and he said, Diane, are you trying to start a vigilante group to roast industry alive? Economic development called my brothers and they told them to make me shut up and not have this meeting. They were trying everything to shut me up on just having a meeting.
Undeterred, Diane invited elected officials.
The county commissioner, the county judge, the senator, mayors, and every one of them refused to come. The senator went on TV and said he was not going to that meeting.
Despite the lack of interest from politicians, there was good reason for a fishing town like Seadrift to be alarmed.
In our bay system, 5 companies discharge directly to the bays. You're looking at 25, 30 million gallons a day going into the estuaries, which is nursery areas, critical habitat of the crabs and the fish and the shrimp, and this is where their discharge is.
One of the major polluters was a plastics plant owned by a Taiwanese company called Formosa. When its wanton pollution sparked massive protests in Taiwan, the company decided to build plants in the U.S., and Texas bent over backwards to attract them.
Texas gave them anything they wanted. They said, we will make sure you don't have to do any permit hearings. We will make sure everything's expedited. They gave them millions upon millions in tax abatements.
And when it came to pollution, they looked the other way. Now the company wanted to expand, and the same agencies were prepared to quietly rubber stamp their permits.
Diane requested a public hearing. That brought more visitors to the docks.
I remember I had a bunch of fishermen sitting in my office, and they saw this black shiny car queued up to the fish house. And fishermen are real nervous about black shiny cars. And they thought it was the IRS, so they all climbed through the window and took off. And it was just the plant manager. And he had all these little papers, and he just wanted me to sign, just give up my request for their hearing. I had no support. I had no money. I had five kids. That's where it started.
Her fellow fishermen were reluctant to get involved.
It was a really tough time. Fishermen believe the last nail was being nailed in their coffin. And when I would go to them trying to get them to come to meetings or sign petitions, they're like, Diane, you can't fight City Hall.
The few allies Diane did have were either bought off or scared off by the company.
It's real typical Formosa. They go after your allies. And so they went after the foremost spokesperson for the fishermen in our county, and he happened to be my cousin, and they hired him as a consultant for $65,000 a year. And all he had to do was when Formosa wanted to go before the commissioners or go before the state agencies, they wanted this fisherman to say, I represent fishermen in Calhoun County, and we like what Formosa's doing. And also, they wanted him to get information about what I was doing. Often, he would come to the fish house, and he'd say, Diane, give me some information to give to him. And I'd say, well, you tell me some information, and I might tell you, you know. I got information on Formosa that way. They tended to go after anyone who was your ally.
Formosa intimidated the board members of Diane's fledgling organization by threatening them with lawsuits. When they all quit, she recruited new ones, poor divorced women with nothing to lose.
Formosa just came in without permits, violating law after law, and just started building.
Diane had a volunteer lawyer working on an injunction to stop construction.
Formosa went after my lawyer, and they literally took my lawyer. I was so despondent. It was like I couldn't stop fighting them, but I couldn't keep on.
She found herself in what she calls her dark night of the soul. So dark that it felt like the only way out was suicide.
I was going to go out like Marilyn Monroe. And I got two packages of sleeping pills, two bottles of alcohol. I took my boat far into the bay. Got on the stern as far to the end as I could, and I laid down and I was like, I'm gonna go to sleep and I'm gonna roll off into the water. That was how I wanted to go. But you know, the funny thing is, I could not go to sleep. I sat there and sat there and finally realized I was not gonna go to sleep. I was not gonna die. So I pulled up the anchor, took back home, and started all over again. That was my dark night of the soul.
Meanwhile, Formosa's expansion kept expanding.
They were going to be discharging 4 to 7 million gallons a day of toxic waste into Lavaca Bay.
By this time, Diane, who never went past high school, had taught herself to write her own legal briefs. She had an appeal on the water permit pending in federal court.
Legally, they could not discharge until the appellate judge responded.
Then Diane learned that the plant Formosa built without a permit was now discharging chemical waste without a permit.
The EPA said, well, it's really up to our discretion if we want to do it or not. When it comes down to the company with a lot of money, the law doesn't matter. And I was so outraged.
She decided to protest by sinking her shrimp boat on top of the plant's outfall pipe.
My cousin, who had been hired by Formosa to watch me, told Formosa, Formosa told the Coast Guard.
Before she got near the pipe, she was intercepted by three Coast Guard boats.
They had these huge microphones, and they said I was a terrorist on the high seas, and I was going to the jail for 19 years. They tied my boat with 10 or 11 ropes, and I was tied, lassoed into my cabin.
That was finally too much for the other fishermen.
I heard this noise, and I looked out the window, and all of these shrimpers, they went out in the middle of the bay and did a demonstration. They had their hands out the window in this fist of defiance and rebellion. It was unbelievable.
The coverage of that protest by big city media so embarrassed Formosa that they agreed to recycle their waste instead of dumping it into the bay, at least on paper. But workers at the plant told Diane a different story.
This is what they do. They're like, Diane, I'm going to tell you something, but I don't want you to use my name. And don't ask me to say it to anybody else but you.
Dale Jurassic, a wastewater foreman at Formosa, arranged to meet her at a bar 40 miles out of town to tell her how supervisors instructed him to dilute samples of discharge water before sending them to the lab, and about millions of plastic pellets being washed into the bay. He tried to blow the whistle. He even called the FBI.
The FBI took a picture of it, and they never did anything with it. Absolutely nothing.
That's when Diane, Dale, and a few other Formosa workers finally took things into their own hands and started collecting the discharged plastic pellets, also known as nurdles.
We had to collect because the EPA wasn't doing anything. The state wasn't doing anything. We would use these little nets you use when you got an aquarium. And eventually there were so many of them, we were using pool nets. You would put them in these little, irony of it, were in these little plastic sandwich bags. Sometimes they were quart bags. Sometimes they were gallon bags. Sometimes they were trash can fulls, bucket fulls. The workers were afraid of being caught with them, so I would stick them in my barn.
In 2016, with the help of Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, Diane took Formosa to court for violating the Clean Water Act. Formosa claimed they were only discharging trace amounts of plastic. So when the case went before the judge, the nurdle collection came too.
Someone had a goat cart and they lended it to me, and we loaded 35 big plastic bins and we took them to federal court in Victoria. And we hauled them straight into those, you know, where they got those little security booths. They nearly had freaked out when they saw us trying to load those bins in.
Then Formosa claimed that the plastic wasn't theirs, but data collected by hundreds of citizen scientists blew that fib out of the water.
Jace Tunnell is the reserve director of the Marine Science Institute at the University of Texas. His group studies how nurdles in the Gulf soak up toxic chemicals.
We're looking at PCBs, PAHs, DDTs, you know, all those acronyms you hear about that define harmful chemicals that absorb into those plastics.
Tiny pieces of this contaminated plastic get eaten by marine life, affecting everything from feeding to reproduction, and work their way up the food chain to people.
So Jace was concerned in the fall of 2018 when he found oodles of nurdles washed up on one of his reserve's beaches.
There were so many of them that I did a post on social media, and immediately somebody said, you need to call the Coast Guard. They ended up calling the state agency. And so the next day I met the state agency out at the beach, called me a couple of days later and said they weren't going to pursue it because they thought it was a spill from offshore or from another country.
Jace wanted to know how far and how fast those nurdles on the beach could travel. So he started a Facebook page to recruit some volunteers.
We were looking at this small stretch of beach that's about 40 miles long. So we figured we needed 4 to 5 volunteers to help us out.
Within a few days, they had over 300.
And it wasn't just on that 40-mile stretch of beach. It was every state in the U.S. on the Gulf Coast, plus organizations and universities down into Mexico.
They called themselves the Nurdle Patrol. The methodology is simple. Once you find your first nurdle, set a timer for 10 minutes, and then see how many you collect before it goes off.
That way we can compare concentrations from one location to the next.
And lo and behold,
these aren't spills that are happening in another country. It's not from offshore. We're finding the highest concentrations way up in the bay systems, where the highest concentrations of plastic manufacturing sites are.
That convinced the judge that Diane's bins of nurdles were Formosa's smoking gun.
And we won, believe it or not. I've never saw anything like that in my life.
The judge found that Formosa was a serial offender for its years of violating the Clean Water Act and ordered them to pay $50 million, the highest penalty ever imposed in a clean water citizen action suit.
The $50 million will go toward restoring the bay, a sustainable fisheries cooperative, research on the health of the estuary and marine microplastics, including the Nurdle Patrol, and environmental education of the next generation. Formosa's Point Comfort plant is just one of hundreds of petrochemical plants that have been built or dramatically expanded over the last decade or are slated for construction. Now we're moving on to St. James, Louisiana, where people are fighting the company's plans to build one of the largest petrochemical plants in the world.
This place was so beautiful at one time. I would travel, go on vacation, and I always wanted to come back to St. James. I never seen anywhere in this world that I wanted to live but St. James. And now the industry have taken part of St. James away from us, and we want it back.
That's Sharon Levine, founder and president of Rise St. James, a local group fighting to stop the Formosa plant.
My daughter called me and told me that the governor was in St. James Parish announcing the approval of a $9.4 billion industry. That's how I found out. When I went home that evening, I turned on the news and I saw for myself the elected officials, like our representative, our senator that represents St. James Parish, and some of the parish council members and the parish president, they were there celebrating with the governor.
St. James Parish is one of the Louisiana counties, they're called parishes here, along a stretch of the Mississippi River called Cancer Alley. This 80-mile corridor between Baton Rouge and New Orleans hosts 200 petrochemical plants and is one of the most polluted regions in the U.S.
If the Formosa complex, which bears the Orwellian title, the Sunshine Project, is allowed to be built, it would be one of the largest polluters of carcinogenic benzene and ethylene oxide in the nation, and would add thousands of tons of soot and ozone to already polluted air.
It would be too much toxic in the air for us to breathe. We will not live. That's why I'm fighting for my life and the life of my community.
Formosa didn't land in Sharon's backyard by accident. Ann Rolfes is the founder and director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, a group that's been helping communities like Sharon's fight polluting industries for 20 years.
St. James Parish as a whole is 50-50 black and white. That seems like there's integration. But if you look more closely, the districts are actually segregated. Fundamentally, the parish has what amounts to a racial cleansing document.
It's called zoning. In 2014, shortly after turning down two petrochemical plants in a predominantly white district, the parish quietly opened two predominantly black residential districts to industrial development.
They did it right under our nose.
Within a year, eight new plants came in, and Sharon watched verdant fields turn into a noxious industrial wasteland.
And as tax revenues from industry rose, the proceeds went disproportionately to the white communities, while the black communities suffered systematic disinvestment.
It was a bigger community at one time. Yes, it was. They sold our grocery stores. They closed our post office. They sold our high school and brought in industry.
Now, the predominantly black 4th and 5th districts have 21 large petrochemical plants and refineries. Air pollution has increased 600%, and residents of nearby towns like Welcome, 97% black, and St. James, 98% black, are getting sick.
So many of my friends are sick with cancer and other problems.
Rise St. James is only 2 years old, and two of its 20 members have already passed away.
They were the two that was with me on the first meeting that I had at my house. They were the first two sitting in my den, and they're gone.
Another Rise St. James member, Myrtle Felton, spoke during a 2019 march from New Orleans to Baton Rouge.
My name is Myrtle Felton. I'm a resident of St. James Parish. I've lived there all my life. I've seen businesses closed, banks closed, school closed, post office closed. We have nothing in Ford District but chemical plants.
She told about a traumatic four-month period in her life when she lost four family members, one after the other, to pollution-related diseases.
I never thought that chemical plants would cause that much damage to a family. And things are getting worse. They promise jobs that our people don't get.
That's right.
We get is debt, sickness. It's just devastating to have to live here, and it's like nobody cares. You know, nobody cares about nothing when it comes down to our community.
Even though the 14 plants in Formosa's mega complex would exacerbate pollution and more than double the cancer risk for nearby residents, the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality approved their air permits. When Rise St. James took the permitting agencies to court and Louisiana's Democratic governor defended them, Reverend Dr. William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign had this to say.
If he supports Formosa and people die, he's just as guilty as that cop that put his knee on George Floyd and strangled him. Because we can't just be moved when people die on camera. People are dying on cancer. I've been there. I've seen the billion-gallon containers that hold all of this poison water that people are worried now if the right storm comes along, if it will burst, and what it could do if it contaminated the river upstream and downstream. I've been there, I've seen the people, and they've decided that they're not just going to die quietly anymore. They're going to fight.
Sharon started out by going to local community groups.
I asked them, what are we going to do about Formosa? And they said, there's nothing we can do about it because the governor approved it. That didn't set good with me in my mind. I was depressed. I was crying. I was so hurt because I thought I had to leave. And I just couldn't leave the place where I was raised. I spoke to God, and he told me to fight. And that's what put the spark in me to want to fight this. Because if we don't fight it, we're not going to live.
So she quit her job as a special education teacher to form a new group, Rise St. James. And as Diane found in Seadrift, it's been hard to get local residents on board.
Me and my organization tried to give them information. Some of them believe and some of them don't. Well, it's hard to believe your own public officials know that these chemicals will kill us and they won't make us aware. It hurts so bad to know that.
They've done marches, spoken out at public meetings, put ads in the paper, and written letters to the editor. But many local people are afraid to speak out.
Their children and grandchildren that's working in industry, they don't want me to put a sign in their yards.
The group has found regional and national allies. The Louisiana Bucket Brigade got its name from the buckets they once used to help people in polluted areas capture air samples. Director Ann Rolfes says they've pretty much abandoned that tactic.
It's like the Wizard of Oz when the wizard says, "Bring me the witch's broom." The state will say, "Prove to us the air is polluted." We do it. We bring it to them and they still do nothing. I'm not wasting my time bringing the broom when it will bring forth zero action.
Now the Bucket Brigade's major tool is media to amplify the voices of local residents and expose the shady dealings of state regulators to the light of day. The David versus Goliath battle against Formosa has gotten national coverage. When Biden speaks about environmental justice, he calls out St. James by name.
Rise St. James and the Bucket Brigade also filed a lawsuit contesting permits issued by the Army Corps of Engineers.
It's really illuminating to read that legal brief. My jaw was on the floor. As bad as I know our regulatory bodies can be, and as rotten as I know Formosa Plastics is, it's a whole nother experience to read these legal briefs and have it explained about just how bad it is. The Army Corps didn't even require an environmental impact statement, saying it was insignificant. Now, how the hell can that be true when it would be one of the largest plastics plants in the world? They didn't consider the burden on the Black community. They didn't consider the destruction of wetlands. We have this coastal zone that's fragile. You know, Louisiana is sinking into the sea. Every year, there's another hurricane that washes off four of our shores. The way that climate change manifests here is through flooding. And yet, the Army Corps of Engineers is going to give the green light and permit to the largest new source of greenhouse gases in the whole country.
The Corps permit would allow disruption of slave graveyards, something Formosa knew about but failed to disclose.
If they had their way, they would be building on top of these graves and nobody would ever know.
In response to that lawsuit, the Army Corps suspended Formosa's permit for reevaluation. And a judge, citing systemic racism, also sent Formosa's air permits back to the state for review. Delia Creamer of the Center for Biological Diversity, which litigates on the group's behalf, describes the overall strategy.
It's a two-part strategy, running the lawsuit and fighting them on the legal battles, and then using that delay. We've already delayed this project significantly. They were supposed to be online producing plastic right now. And then in the meantime, as we're delaying, we're changing the public opinion and building people power.
A delay is just a temporary reprieve.
Our president and commander-in-chief has the power to make that permanent.
This is in Biden's court.
And in ours, as the people power, to make sure his decisions come down on the side of justice. Look for actions you can take at our website, cool-solutions.org. If President Biden does walk his talk on environmental justice and revokes the permit, this will be a victory for more than just St. James. Remember when the fishermen said, you can't fight City Hall? And when Sharon's community organization said, the governor approved it, there's nothing we can do.
There's this idea that these big plants are a done deal or that you can't stop them. And I think with Formosa Plastics, we were really proving that notion wrong. In one corner, we have this huge company, Formosa. In another, we have a small Black community. The odds were against St. James, and they're not dead yet, but we surely have them on the ropes. When we beat Formosa, it, I think, will be a shockwave that ripples, because it is one of the world's largest companies wanting to build one of the world's largest plastics plants in a historic Black community. It would wipe that community off the face of the earth.
Anne and Sharon are optimistic that that's not going to happen and that St. James has better days ahead.
St. James is going to thrive. Once we stop Formosa, then we're going after the others that's poisoning my community. Then we're going to win.
I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis.
And you've been listening to Cool Solutions, Climate Action from the Bottom Up. Many thanks to our guests,
Diane Wilson, Jace Tunnell, Sharon Levine,
Ann Rolfes, and Delia Creamer. And to Lahar, Huma Huma, and Scott Holmes for our music.